Good afternoon. So last time we talked about the process of going from potentially multiple source files to an executable. We talked about this intermediate file you've probably seen before called object files and what was in there. And the big thing is, like, we had assembly files that we turn into these object files. So that was where we handled the process of converting assembly to machine code. But they weren't complete because we couldn't just execute them. And the main reason why is we had information in other files we wanted to use along with, you know, one assembly file. So, like, we would have, like, a call to printf, but we need to use a printf that's going to have code in some other file. So we have these placeholders for where we're, say, calling a printf function, and symbol table entries for things that those placeholders might reference, like the declaration of printf. And the linkers are responsible for taking all these object files, looking at those relocation table entries to figure out where the placeholders are, and doing that substitution, looking up the locations that will go in the placeholders using the symbol table. So the relocation table says, here's a placeholder, and we want you to look for this name to go in it. And the symbol table says, here are the names and where they should point to when you're filling in placeholders. And when the linker's working, it knows what the executable actually looks like. So it knows, you know, given that it knows, say, printf is in this file, it knows where that's going to end up in the executable and can fill in the corresponding relocation entries to actually point to that location where the printf declaration ends up. And we mentioned, well, this was the process of static linking, where all our work was done when we made the executable, where we didn't have anything to do to start an executable other than load it and jump to it. But often, that's not the way executables work, mainly because we want to avoid having redundant code stored multiple times on our systems. So instead, we'll place that code in a separate library file and load it when we start the executable. And this is known as dynamic linking, where we'll basically be doing part of that linking stuff, part of those filling and relocations when executable starts, because we won't have the information earlier. After talking about linking, we started talking about some miscellaneous C topics. The big one was talking about pointer arithmetic. So we mentioned that in C, when you use a pointer, you can add to it, and that's equivalent to adding to the address, with one major caveat, which is that when we have a pointer that, say, points to ints, we add that number of ints of space. So if ints are 4 bytes, we add 4 times n when we add n to a pointer to ints instead of n. And we also learned that this is how array indexing works. And that means that when we have an array in C, it is a different type than a pointer. But when we try to use it in this sort of way to either index an array or do arithmetic, it becomes a pointer to the beginning of the array. And then we briefly talked about undefined behavior, this notion that, well, you know, C is not a language defined by a particular implementation. Like, we don't say C is what GCC does. Instead, there's this specification, and sometimes the specification deliberately doesn't decide things. And one example we gave was signed integer overflow. The way you learned how 2's complement worked in 2150, you'd say, oh, well, of course, when we add 1 to the biggest possible int, we get the smallest possible int. And that makes a lot of sense. But the people who specify what C is said, nah, compilers can do whatever they like. You know, we don't care. And because they don't care, you as a developer of C programs basically need to not do that if you want predictable behavior. Like, even one compiler might do different things in different circumstances depending on what it finds convenient. So, questions about topics we covered last time? Okay, so no questions about linking is kind of surprising because I know the quiz did not go well. Or sorry, way back there. What exactly is tracked in the object file in the executable? Can you be more specific?
So are my analysts asking about the quiz?
The quiz that's already due, yes.
Okay. So question 4, one of the options was location within the object file generated from main.s, and where the string appears, right? But I thought that location wasn't tracked because it was in a different section, and instead the only location that was tracked was the variable name.
OK, so you're asking, why did we say that location was tracked? And the reason why is that if you looked at the assembly file, we had a label %d that pointed to that string. So we need to have a symbol table entry for %d, and that symbol table entry is going to tell us where that string is because that's what the label points to. So indeed, if we didn't have that there, there wouldn't be a reason to have that information tracked. But since we do, we have to have it in a convenient form for the linker, so when someone else uses %d, which was in fact even marked as available to other files, it could be used. So that's why %d, the location of that string, was something that was tracked in the object file. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Can you explain option 5 why that's true? It says includes the location of the machine code in the move B RDI to AI.
So the question is, on question 5, we said that the object files included the location of the move B, as something in the symbol table or the relocation table.
Yes, in the symbol table.
And the reason why is that that is the instruction that's labeled by the printf label. So when we say printf, we're pointing to that particular instruction. And to make that work, we need to know where it is so the linker can set up a pointer to that particular instruction. Yes? So the question is, does it just point to that instruction, or does it point to the whole chunk of code? So can you put a mess, please? And it's true that if you look at assembly files generated by the compiler, sometimes they'll have a marker for the beginning and end of the function. So if that was in the assembly file, the symbol table could have extra information like that. But the assembly we showed didn't have any annotations like that, so the assembler has no way of knowing how big the function is, right? Because unless it really analyzes the assembly code, so it won't have that information in our case, but you could add annotations to the assembly file to let the assembler write that down. So if you look at the assembly a compiler generates, sometimes you'll see extra assembler directives that allow it to say, here's the beginning and end of printf. But if that's not there, all it has is the beginning. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So on the quiz, since people had trouble, I'll use this example of a piece of assembly here. So here we have a label loop. So that might have a symbol table entry for loop that specifies this instruction, because if some other code jumps to loop or calls loop, that's where it would go. We need a placeholder for %d. So when we generate the machine code for this, there's going to be some part of the machine code that's %d. And because we make a placeholder, we make a relocation table entry for %d that references this instruction. Questions? Yes, yeah.
Wait, so why is %d why does it get a placeholder and not an actual number location?
So why don't we have the actual memory location? So when we're making the object file, we don't know where the percent D is going to be in memory yet. So we can't actually fill in the location in the instruction. The question is, we would know where RDI is. So RDI is a register. So in the machine code, we're going to write RDI as, you know, just a constant value in the machine code is going to say this is RDI. But for percent D, well, it's going to be a constant value in the machine code, but we don't know which one yet, because it depends where it ends up in memory. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So when I introduced what was in the object files, I kind of glossed over an issue that I think may have tripped some people up. So I gave the sort of idea that, our symbol table contains all the labels, and the assembler in Linux takes some shortcuts from this. So we could do this. This would be a valid way of implementing things, but that would mean that we might have lots of labels that aren't very useful in object files. So to avoid this, the assembler in Linux, it tracks all the labels. So internally, when it's processing an assembly file, it kind of builds a symbol table with all labels, but it only writes out the ones that are marked with something like .global. Where the idea is that if you have symbols that aren't marked with .global, you're telling the assembler, I'm going to use this, but only in this file. Then you might say, wait a moment, if I'm going to use it in this file, how do I write a relocation table entry for that? And the solution for that is the assembler can write, replace this placeholder with the address of wherever, the 10th byte of the data segment ends up in memory, rather than label something. And that's just as a shorthand to avoid making the symbol table as big, basically, for things that are references within the current file. Between files, we still have to use labels all the time. That's what you'll see. So. And related to this, another thing which confused people is that I gave an example which had this .l str symbol. And that looks like an assembler directive. You might say it's awfully confusing that we have a symbol, a label, that is named starting with a dot. Is that really a label? Yes, it is. You can, in fact, have labels, in the least in Linux's assembler, that start with a dot, even though you might think that's for assembler directives. And the convention that the compiler uses when generating assembly is that dot capital L labels are just local to the current file, kind of like a static function in C. Questions on this idea that, just the assembler's taking this shortcut to avoid writing out things that are only used in the current file to the object file symbol table? Okay, so then let's move on to our main topic for today, which is going to be about bit manipulation. And we're going to talk about sort of this going from what we can do easily in hardware to manipulate bits to what we can provide to the software and what is provided to the software. And in hardware, well, bits are values on wires. So we have a bunch of wires, and it has a high voltage for one, a low voltage for zero. That's usually what we do. And if we have an 8-bit value, it's a bundle of 8 wires. And this means that if we want to do something to particular bits of a value, we just do something to one of those wires and ignore the others. But things aren't so easy in software because, we don't have individual wires. We have registers that are many bits. So let's start with a problem here. Let's say I want to take a byte and extract the 4 most significant bits. So the top nibble, if we're talking decimal, so given OXAB, I want to extract OXA. So how can I do this? And if you started on the BitLab, you might know, there's a bunch of special operators for this. But there's a way of doing this, even if you know nothing about those bit manipulation operators, with just math. Someone tell me what the just math way of doing this is. Normal math, nothing, yeah.
And it with F?
So you're saying we can use and? That is, so ending it with F, that would extract OXB. We'll get to that later. And I want to use just math, no bit minute, no new operators. Operators you definitely know if you took CS1. And that's it, yeah. Divide by 16. So no special new operators needed. Okay, so we can divide by 16. But this works, and it's straightforward mathematically to do it. But if we think of generating the most straightforward assembly for this, it's not actually very great. So in the hardware, this operation is going to be just using these wires here and ignoring the other ones. It's free. Like, there's no computation involved. It should take essentially no time. And, you know, the straightforward mathematical way of doing it is division. And division, you know, there's a divide instruction, and division is surprisingly slow. So on Skylight, which is similar to my laptop's processor, a division takes around 6 cycles. In addition, for contrast, you can do about 4 of them per cycle. So this is 24 times slower than addition. Now, but this should be a special case of division. We shouldn't need to do the general division thing. We should be able to do something a lot faster because it's a lot simpler. We'll see that there is going to be a way. So a question back there?
Why does dividing by 16 work?
This question is, why does dividing by 16 work? Okay. So if we think of OXAB, so A is going to be the digit 10, B is 11. And if we think of how hexadecimal works, this is 10 times 16 to the 1 plus 11 times 16 to the 0. If we divide this by 16, this part is going to be the remainder. And that 16 to the 1 cancels out, and we are left with 10. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so in hardware, this is really simple. And when we're looking at this as hardware designers, we should say, is there a way we can expose that this is really simple as some operation for programmers to use that's simpler than division to expose this special case? And that operation exists. And in x86, there's an instruction, SHR, for shift right, which exposes that. So basically, we take a value, we shift over by a certain number write words, where we put on the rightmost side the least significant bit, the value. Now, if we're just shifting the bits over, we have a question here, which is, what about the higher bits? Because we're taking a register of a fixed size, say 32 bits, for example, maybe, and shifting it over. In this example, it's as if I supplied an amount of 4 or a CL value of 4, but then we have 4 bits at the top that need to have a value because our registers are 32 bits. We can't turn a 32-bit register into a 28-bit register. And this instruction needs to make a choice about what to put there, and the choice they make is they put in zeros. So questions about the shift right instruction? Yes.
Do the numbers that are shifted right, like at the very end, like the 0010, do they go into the next?
So the question is, what happens to those last least significant 4 bits? They are discarded. Other questions? Yes.
Would this instruction change any of the condition flags?
questions with this instruction change condition flags? I believe it does, but I'd have to look it up. Other questions? Yeah. The question is, how does this relate to division? We will get to that explicitly later. That's a good question, yeah, but we'll answer that in great detail in a bit. So our original function, where we're dividing by 16, we can do as a shift by 4, which is our first hint as to what the correlation is, but we'll get to more detail. So here's an implementation. There's this funny first instruction. This move ZBL is move byte to long, where so 8-bit to 32-bit, adding zeros to handle them being different sizes. Because if you remember our C function, it took in a char, a single byte value, and returned it. Okay, so questions about this assembly code? And you might say, oh, okay, so you can write this in assembly. How can I do this in C? You know, or do I have to switch to assembly if I want the good bit manipulation operator? And the answer is, well, there's a C operator for this. You might know it from its being repurposed for IO streams in C++. But this double greater than is the shift right operator. So this is C code that compiles into something like that assembly. Question? Yes. So why is it SHRL instead of just SHR? So I could have written SHR, and it would assemble correctly. I'm just being more explicit about the size being shifted. Yes? So your question is, would the compiler optimize the divide by 16 to become SHR? And the answer is usually yes. So if I, in my compiler, when I turned on optimizations, that's in fact, my compiler in fact generated the same code for these two. It decided to do the shift before the add zeros operation, but it would be the same either way. Questions? Okay, so then let's get to how this works out to math. So we know that the shift by 4 is dividing by 16, and the general rule is that our shift is going to be dividing by, shifting by y is dividing by 2 to the y, rounding down. And that the detail is rounding down. Okay, so for example, 10 shifted over 2, well, 10 divided by 2 to the 2 would be 10 divided by 4, which is 2.5, but it ends up being getting a result of 2 when we shift it over. Some questions? Not equivalence? We can think of it as rounding down because we're discarding those extra bits rather than using them to like round up in some circumstances. Okay, so now that we know what shift right does, what the SHR instruction does, question here. So here's a function declared in C as foo that takes an int, returns an int. And let's say I call it with negative 2 and I have its assembly. So what does it return? I'll give you some time to figure that out. Check with your neighbors if you agree. Okay, who'd like some more time? A couple people? Okay. Okay, who still would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, okay, D, E, F, G, H. Okay, so the majority of you figured out the correct answer, which is that it becomes a large positive number. And to think about this, we need to remember to use complement, which maybe you in 2150 you hope you never have to use again. Sorry. So one way of thinking about 2's complement is that our sign bit, it has the value of negative 2 to whatever place it's in. So for a 32-bit number, negative 2 to 31. Another way of viewing it is we can have this kind of circle of numbers where when we go clockwise around this circle, we add 1. And negative 1, therefore, is the all 1's value, and wraps around to 0. And our most positive value wraps around to the most negative value. And if we think about what happens with our negative 2, well, our negative 2 is going to be, it's going to be right here. It's going to be 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, because when we add 1 to it, we get negative 1, the all 1's value. And when we shift it over by 1, we're going to add in a 0 at the beginning and remove a 0 at the end, so we'll end up with exactly the most positive number here. So this number here is exactly what we'll end up with from that SHR operator. And you might say, wait a moment, that just contradicted what you said about how it corresponds to division, because that's clearly not the dividing by 2 to the, in this case, 1, and rounding down, which would be negative 1. So what happened? Well, the shift right operator, the SHR instruction, sorry, is unsigned, basically. And this is a case where, unlike many things we've been used to, we have to distinguish between signed and unsigned operations. And, you know, so add like it didn't matter, but for shift, right, corresponding to division, it does. So you might say, how do we make this give the correct result for signed numbers? So one way of thinking about what's going on is, let's say we wanted to use our SHR operator, the one we have, to divide by 2. So and divide a negative number by 2. So what we can do is we can take our negative number, negative x, and we can turn it into positive x for doing the division and then turn it back. And how do we make a number, negate a number in 2's complement? You may remember the rule is flip all the bits and add 1. So like if I take 1 and flip all the bits and add 1, I get negative 1. If I take 2 and flip all the bits and add 1, I get negative 2, and so on. That's our rule for moving something into 2's complement. So we do that to get positive x. We right shift by 1 to get x divided by 2. And then we convert it back to negative x divided by 2 by flipping all the bits again and adding 1. And you'll notice that we're right shifting by 1 and then flipping all the bits. So ignoring the adding 1 part, what this is doing is that we're shifting the number over and shifting in a 0, that then gets flipped to a 1. So except for some rounding issues, which is going to be whatever the adding one we were doing before and after flipping, this is very similar to shifting, but rather than shifting in zeros, shifting in ones. And so that suggests maybe you want a version of the shift operator that will shift in ones for negative numbers. And x86, in fact, provides one, which it calls the arithmetic right shift, is the SAR instruction. And what it does is it, rather than shifting in zeros, it shifts in a copy of the highest bit, the sign bit. So if we start off with a sign bit of 0, it shifts in zeros. If we start off with a sign bit of 1, it shifts in ones, rather than always shifting in zeros. And this is going to do something much closer to division for signed numbers, but of course for unsigned numbers, it's going to be wrong. Right? It's not going to be division. So questions about this SAR instruction? Okay, so this is called an arithmetic right shift. The other type of shift is sometimes called a logical right shift. And you might say, okay, so this looks convenient for doing things with signed numbers. How do I access it in C? And generally, the C compiler will choose which one to use based on what you're shifting. If you're shifting a signed number, it will use the arithmetic shift instruction. Otherwise, it will use the logical shift instruction. Some questions? Selection. Okay. So what I'm telling you here is it's true practically speaking, but this is a case where we run into a little trouble with that like formal specification of C. The people who actually specified C didn't specify this. Instead, they said, if you're shifting a signed number right, it's implementation defined, meaning it's not undefined. The compiler can't do whatever it wants. The compiler needs to make a choice and document it. But every single, at least x86 compiler I know of, does an arithmetic shift. I think the reason why they let compilers choose to do other things is that there's some platforms where doing an arithmetic shift is very inconvenient, and there's some platforms, in theory, though I have never seen one in common use in the past 20 years, that don't use 2's complement. But we're going to assume that it's going to be arithmetic shift in this class because that's what you'll almost always see. So another thing about the shift operator is that you'd probably think that if you had, say, an int x and did x over, say, 60, that you'd think that this would be 0, right? You shift over 0 or negative 1. If x was positive, you think it would be 0. Then you shift in a whole bunch of zeros. And that makes sense. That is not what happens. Shifting by more than the width of the type you're shifting, so for an int 32 bits, is undefined behavior. The compiler can do anything. And this is a case where you actually will get in trouble for this, because the corresponding x86 assembly instruction for shift right only looks at the bottom bits of the shift amount. So if you use the assembly instruction to shift by 60, the processor only looks at the bottom 5 bits of 60 to determine how much to shift. It doesn't look at anything else. And why 5 bits? Because 5 can represent up to 31, the maximum amount they think you want to shift by. Sorry. So don't shift by more than the width of a type, even though it seems like it should work. It won't. And it's just a silly special rule. Questions about things being implementation and undefined? Yes?
Does this affect like the zero flag or the prime flag?
Does this affect the zero sign flag? Does the SAR instruction do that, or the shifting in general do that? I believe it has some effect on the flags. I don't know exactly what it is offhand. Other questions? Okay. So now let's do this exercise. Now that we have a shift that might actually do sign division. So I'm shifting by 2, which should be similar to dividing by 4. I would write something down to solve this, but maybe you can do it in your head. Okay, who would like some more time? A bunch of people, okay. Okay, who'd still like more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Okay, so I get negative 2. I'll show exactly what I was doing. So I take 6 in binary, that's 110. I flip all the bits, get this thing, a bunch of 1, 0, 0, 1, add 1. So we take our plus 1, carry the 1 to get that 10 at the end. And then I shift, arithmetic shift by 2. So the 10 at the end goes away, and I add 2 ones at the beginning to figure out what that is. If I don't remember, it's negative 2. I flip all the bits and add 1, and I get 2, or 10 and base 2. So it's negative 2. Questions how I came up with that answer? So there might be a question of how does this correspond to our idea that this shift by 2 should correspond to dividing by 4. So if we divide negative 6 by 4, we expect to get 3/2, negative 3/2. And the question is, do we round negative 3/2 to negative 2 or negative 1? And, well, we round down to negative infinity. And the general rule that I'm not going to bother to prove, but I'm sure you can, is that the arithmetic shift rounds towards negative infinity when it does a division. So it does a division, but the rounding is towards negative infinity. And this notably is not what the divide operator does in C. The divide operator in C rounds towards 0. It truncates. And you might say, okay, so this means if I write x divided by 16, and x is signed, that means the compiler can't do the shift by 4. And, well, it can't just do the shift by 4, but division is so slow that the compiler will make it work. So, for example, here's some code that was generated by me dividing a signed number by 8 by GCC. It is doing the work to implement this with an arithmetic shift by 3, so 2 to the third is 8, and it has this extra code to fix the rounding being quote-unquote wrong. And what does it do? If the number is negative, it first adds 7 before doing that, so the rounding will work out correctly. Just like you might add 0.5 before rounding if you have something rounding to the nearest integer that's rounding to the wrong integer. And it does this with a little, some instructions you probably haven't seen before, but that's why I have the assembly annotated. Some questions about this strategy of adding this bias value to fix the rounding for our negative numbers? Yes?
So you added the 7 because it rounds to a negative, right? So that you want to,
I guess. So the question is, we're adding the 7 so it rounds to something else? Yeah, so as an example, in this case, if we start with negative 9 dividing by 8, we want to get negative 1, not negative 2. So we add 7 first, so we're actually shifting negative 1 over to get negative 1 again. Because if we shifted negative 9 over directly, we'd get negative 2 because of the rounding to negative infinity. Or not negative 1, negative 2, but yeah. So, other questions, follow-ups? Okay, so we talked about shifting right and division. So there's also shifting left, where we want to take some bits and move them over in a number, which in the machine is really simple. We just add some wires with zeros on them. And this is also equivalent to the mathematics operation of multiplying by a power of 2. And you might say, okay, so we just shift by a negative number, right? Shift right by a negative number? Yep, that makes sense. Sorry, it's just not legal. You can't do it in C, you can't do it in assembly. So instead, there's a different operator in C, the less than operator, which you may also know from IO streams as something else, and there's a shift left instruction. Unlike right shifting, we don't have to deal with rounding. We're always going to get an exact answer or overflow. So there's not two usefully different versions of this instruction. If you look up the x86 manual, there is an arithmetic shift left instruction, but it's not interestingly different from SHL. So this is the only shift operation mathematically. And shifting by an amount is equivalent to multiplying by that power 2. Shifting by y is multiplying by 2 to the y. So questions about shift left? I guess I should, since I skipped over it, we always shift in zeros because this is not a case where shifting in copies of anything makes sense. Because we don't, again, don't have anything going wrong with negative numbers, naturally. Besides overflow, but that happens with positive too. Okay, so now let's look at a different problem with bit manipulation. And that's, well, I started with extracting the most significant 4 bits of a byte. Now let's extract 4 bits from the middle of a value. So again, like what we started with, we can do this with just math. And to do it with just math, I'm going to divide this up into 2 steps. So I'm going to take my value, and I'm first going to strip off the lower 4 bits, and then I'm going to strip off the upper 8 bits. And for the first step, stripping off the lower 4 bits, we've seen how to do that, hopefully. So which one of these operators does that? I'll give you 20 seconds, hopefully should be quick, because we just covered it. We'll find out if not. Okay, so who thinks A? B, C, D. Okay, so it is in fact B. So the second part is a little trickier. We're going to talk about another way of doing it that isn't so mathematical in a second. That's kind of like when we went from division to shifting. We're going to have an equivalent for this operation, but there's a mathematical way of doing this. So what is it? I'll give you time to do it. And one way of thinking about this is remember that idea that our value here, you know, that this is 1 times 16 to the 2 plus OXF, or 15 times 16 to the 1 plus 2 times 16 to the 0. That's a way we can think about this value that will help us figure out the mathematical way of dealing with it. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? B? Okay, C? D? E? F? G? Okay, so most people got D, which is the correct answer. So the way I think about this, I want to get the 2. If I divide by 16 and take the remainder, that means that I, because of how this worked out in, you know, when we expanded this hexadecimal representation, that gets rid of this value because it's 16 times something, and it gets rid of this value because it's 16 times something. So we're left with the 2. That is a way of extracting that 2. And some people had the mod 256, so that would extract everything except the thing that's multiplied by 16 to the 2, so that would extract the F2 instead of just 2. So it's an interesting operation, just not the one we wanted here. So I have that solution written at the front. We could also have done it in the opposite direction, where I extract 2,0 and then turn the 2,0 into 2 by chopping off the last 4 bits by shifting. But we'd like a way of doing this that doesn't involve this modulus operator. Because you might ask, well, how is the modulus operator implemented in the straightforward way in assembly? And the answer is with the division instruction. That's the general version of it, because we actually use the division instruction, which I mentioned is slow. And this operation in hardware, it's really simple. And we'd like to expose that it's really simple to extract particular bits to the software. And this is going to need some mechanism that doesn't look like our shift operations to make that easy. And what we're going to do is we're going to try to expose sort of the simple operations we have to manipulate bits in the hardware to the software. And these are what are known as gates. So gates are these hardware components where we have some wires as input that have ones or zeros. And we'll deal with just gates with two inputs. So this example is what's called an XOR gate. So it takes in two inputs. If they're both zero, its output is zero. If they're both one, its output is zero. Otherwise, if they're zero and one or one and zero, the output is one. So this is a sort of low-level bit manipulation thing the hardware has, and we'd like to make this available to the software. We'll see that these are going to be helpful for doing things like extracting particular bits. And we'll talk first about probably the most useful in software of these gates, which is going to be AND. And I'm going to represent the possible outputs of AND with this truth table. So this says that if we AND 1 with 1, we get 1. Otherwise, we get 0. And if we're given a way of ANDing a bit with something, this means that if we AND that bit with 1, we keep the bit the same. If we AND that bit with 0, we clear that bit. So extracting particular bits of a number, how we're going to do that, we're going to tell the processor to AND the bits of the number we want to keep with 1, AND the bits of the number we don't want to keep with 0. And we'll call our instructions on how to do that a mask, and we'll represent that as a number where we have ones where we want to keep the bit the same and zeros otherwise that we'll call a mask. And our processor is going to provide what we'll call a bitwise AND operation, which will take this mask and apply it, doing this AND operation bit by bit for each pair of bits between our mask and our input, to do this keeping or clearing operation. And in C, you can use this AND operation with the ampersand operator. That's bitwise AND. So it treats its two operands as arrays of bits and ANDs bit by bit. So for example, if we do two bitwise AND with 4, well, the ones place of 2 is 0, and the one place of 4 is 0. And 2 ANDed with 4, even our truth table, was 0. So the ones place of our result is 0. The 2's place of 2 is 1. The 2's place of 4 is 0. 1 ANDed with 0 is 0. The 4's place of 2 is 0. The 4's place of 4 is 1. 0 ANDed with 1 is 0. And then we have 0 ANDed with 0. So we're going bit by bit for each pair to construct a result. So 2 ANDed with 4 ends up being 0. You never have two ones in a column. The other hand, 10 ANDed with 7, our 1's place, we have 0 ANDed with 1 is 0. Our 2's place, we have 1 ANDed with 1 is 1. Then 0 ANDed with 1 is 0, and so on, and we get a result of 2. Only the 2's place is set, everything else is clear. And if we go back to my description of this idea of keeping and clearing bits, well, 7 is a number which has 1's in the 1's, 2's, and 4's place, the three least significant bits, and 0's otherwise. So we can think of 7 as a mask that says, keep the three least significant bits, clear everything else. And we can see that that was done here for 10. We kept the three least significant bits of 10, which were 0, 1, 0, and we cleared all the other bits. We made them 0 regardless of what was there before. So by ending with 7, we extracted the three least significant bits of 10 in this example. So questions about that in this operation? How the AND operator works? Okay. So in C, this is the single ampersand operator. In assembly, this is the AND instruction. Now, you might say, gosh, when you were showing me how this worked, it looked like an awful tedious calculation. I need to go bit by bit. And it sounds like the hardware's like running a loop. Maybe this is not actually that fast. And it is going to be efficient in the hardware, and that's because the hardware can have parallelism. So the hardware for typical implementation, not guaranteed, but typically for one of these bitwise operations is that they're just going to have a separate physical gate, a separate component to calculate each bit, which means that they'll all happen at the same time, and it should be really efficient. That even though you would probably calculate it by going bit by bit, the hardware is doing all the bits at once. So it should be fast. Yes?
So this hardware exists between every combination of registers?
This question is, this hardware exists between every combination of registers? No, so there's going to be some hardware I'm not showing to route values from registers to this hardware. We'll kind of talk about that later in the semester. Other questions? Okay, yes. This question with 7 being a mask. So I said that when we're thinking about the AND operation, because we can think about ending with 1 means that we're saying to keep a bit the same, because if we end 0 with 1, we get 0. If we end 1 with 1, we get 1. Ending with 0 means to clear a bit, because no matter what the original bit is, we get 0. So we can think of ending with 7 as ending with something where the last three bits we specified a 1, meaning we want to keep the bit, and the other bits we want to clear. So we can think of X ended with 7 as a way of saying, keep the last three bits, clear the others. And 7 is a mask that specifies that operation. Does that make sense? Okay. So knowing this way of using bitwise AND, we can rewrite our modulus operation to use bitwise AND. So rather than taking mod 16, I can keep the last four bits by ending with a mask which has the last four bits set, which is OXF or 15, and everything else cleared. Alternately, I can keep four bits at the beginning by ending with a mask which has the most significant bits of the first byte, F0, set, and everything else clear, and then shift over to move the values to the correct place at the least significant part of the number rather than four bits higher. And I've shown down here what happens where each of these letters represents one bit. So we start with a number which is 16 bits, where I'm writing AAA for the first four bits and then BBB for the next four, where by first I mean most significant. So we do a shift over to chop off the last four bits, and then we do this AND with 1111. So to keep only the C bits, the other ones get cleared. And we keep the C bits, meaning that if the C bits are zeros, they'll stay zeros. If they're ones, they'll stay ones. And in the second example, first we clear all the bits but the C bits, and then we shift over the C bits to get them at the end. Some questions about how these two ways of extracting those four bits work? And if you compile these to assembly, works slightly differently, but they use the instructions we told you about, the AND instruction for the bitwise AND, and that shift right instruction for the actual shift. Right. So AND is just one of the operators. We also have two other bitwise operators that are different gates. We have OR. And I think of OR as a way of conditionally setting bits. So if we have a mask with zeros where we want to keep things the same, and ones where we want to set bits, that's what OR does. And XOR is a way of conditionally flipping bits. So if we have a mask with ones where we want to flip bits and zeros otherwise, that's what XOR does. So if you want to keep certain bits and clear the others, you use AND. If you want to keep certain bits and set the others no matter what they were before, you use OR. If you want to keep certain bits and flip the others, you use XOR. So questions about these other bitwise operations? Yes?
How do they know which, are all the gates different?
The question is, are all these gates different? Yes, so there will be, okay, I guess, I'm not sure, but in the simplest implementation, you just have separate gates, and depending on which instruction you use, the processor would choose to use different sets of gates. I could imagine ways of sharing circuitry, but I don't think it's worth it. Other questions? Okay, and all these bitwise operators, they work the same way as bitwise AND. They go bit by bit in each case. So OR and XOR, like that. There's one other bitwise operator which doesn't fit the pattern we saw, and that's the complement operator, and this flips all the bits. So you might know of the bing or logical negation operator, the exclamation point operator, which turns 0 into 1 and everything else into 0 because it makes true values false and false values true. That's how we do that in C. Remember, 0 is false, everything else is true. So the complement operator just flips each bit individually. So it's kind of the bitwise analogy to the exclamation point operator. And typically, this means that we end up with negative numbers and we start with positive ones if we're dealing with signed numbers. And also, unlike other bitwise operators, this is a case where you really need to know how big the value you're dealing with is. Some questions about the complement operator? Yes?
With calculating true's complement,
The question, do they use the complement operator to do this?
Yes.
So on x86, there's a separate negation instruction.
Okay.
But that might not be true everywhere. And the question is, do they use this complement to do the indication? And sometimes, maybe, but not on x86, probably. Other questions? Okay, so our lab and homework for this week are a bunch of bit manipulation puzzles. And in these puzzles, you're going to solve some problem with bitwise operations that you could do with more normal arithmetic and comparisons. And we're not having you do this because we think this is something you should do in all your code. It's good for thinking about hardware design because these bitwise operations are closer to the tools the hardware has to do operations. It's good for understanding the bitwise operations, which we'd like you to do. So we'd like you to know how to manipulate bits if you have to do that when you get out of this class, even though maybe what we'll have you do in the problems might not be the easiest way to solve that particular example if you could do arithmetic instead. And also, we've heard that this is an unreasonably common interview type. Some people think you're clever if you can solve these puzzles, even though it probably more means you have practice solving them. So I'm going to go through an example of some of these problems. I'm going to do one in the remaining time and probably do another at the beginning of next time to try to go through some sort of approaches generally. So I'm going to start off by implementing the ternary operator using sort of bitwise instructions and arithmetic. So the ternary operator is basically, we have x question mark y colon z. This is basically if x, return y, else return z. So it's an if-then. So the most straightforward way of implementing it would be with if-else. We're going to look at how we can do it without that. And do it without any ifs or else, meaning that this code we'll generate probably wouldn't have jumps if it were assembly. And this is a really daunting task to do if you just start with that description. And I don't think you're likely to succeed if you just like look at that, try to stare at it, and figure it out. So the way I would go about this is try to solve subproblems and generalize your solution. So I'm going to build my solution by simplifying the problem way down. So the first simplification I'm going to make is, well, I don't know how to solve this for any x, y, and z. Why don't we try making it so x, y, and z are only 1 or 0? Because that's going to make it a lot simpler, especially with bitwise operations. And I can worry later about how do I make it work with bigger x, y, or z. And then I'm going to divide and conquer further by fixing z to be 0 or y to be 0. And you might say, why is that useful? So I'm going to start with my constraint that x, y, and z are just 0 or 1. And I'm going to divide it into these two subproblems. And the way I've chosen these subproblems, basically I've said I'm going to solve if x return y, else 0, and if and not x return 0, else return z. So those are the two subproblems I'm going to do. Your question might be, well, how is solving those two problems going to help us solve the bigger problem? So something to observe is that if I or add these solutions together, that's going to give us our result. Because if I or these together, well, if x is 1, then I'm going to get y ordered with 0, because the first part line turns into y, the second line turns into 0. If x is 0, I'm going to get 0 ordered with z, because the first line turns into 0, the second line turns into z, and y ordered with 0 is y, z ordered with 0 ordered with z is z. So if I OR these two solutions together, I get a solution to the whole problem here. So if I solve the first subproblem and the second subproblem and just OR them together, I have a solution to the big problem. And this is a very common strategy you'll see in these sort of bit puzzles, that you can make these subproblems where you OR or possibly add the two solutions together, and you get a solution to a bigger problem. That makes sense? Questions? About why that works. Okay, kind of surprised there's none, but that's great. So let's look at this first subproblem here. So this is if x is true, I want to return y. Otherwise, I want to return 0, and we know x can only be 0 or 1. And y can only be 0 or 1, so I can make a truth table. And I can look at this truth table and say, gosh, that looks familiar. That's the AND operation. So I'm done. I just do a bitwise AND. And I only care about one bit, so that's what it's going to do. Great. And for the second subproblem, we had if x returns 0, LC. So this is the same as the first one if I flip the bit of x. So I can do tilde x, and it would c, and that will give me that answer. And then to get the solution to the whole thing, I just OR those two solutions together. So that's what I have for our constraint that x, y, and z are just 0 or 1. That's my full solution. Some questions on how I figured that out and why this works? Before I move on to something that we'll probably need to understand this. Okay, so the inconvenient thing here is that, you know, I'm restricting y and z to be just 0 or 1. That helped a lot because I could make that whole truth table. So let's work on doing this without that constraint. So we're still going to have x just be 0 or 1. We'll worry about fixing that later. And the old solution doesn't work. So let's first prove it doesn't work. So let's say we have x equals 1, y equals 2, and z equals 0. That's an example where it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Well, if we do 1 added with 2, that's going to be 0. Why is it going to be 0? Because of 0, 0, 0, 1. Bitwise AND with 0, 0, 1, 0. That's zeros. And then we have tilde X ended with C. That's also going to be 0 because anything ended with 0 is 0. That's what C is. So we get a result of 0 when we expect a result for this expression, for our expression here of Y or 2. So makes sense why this doesn't work as is. We need to do something special. Okay, so let's look at our first subproblem in this more general way. So we saw the pattern we did is we ANDed Y with something to select based on X. And previously we were selecting the last bit of Y if X was true and nothing if X was 0. If X is 1, nothing if X was 0. But instead what we want to do, if X is 1, we want to keep all the bits of Y. And if X is 0, we want to keep none of the bits of Y. So we can turn this into AND Y with a mask, where we want to select a mask of all 1s, if X is 1, and 0s otherwise. So in hardware, we'd probably solve this by like replicating all the bits of X to make this mask. If we're talking about doing arithmetic, we have a trick here, which is if we remember our 2's complement, that all 1's number, that's negative 1. So we can just use negative X. Okay, so how about the second half? We just want the opposite. So it's not negative X, but if we just turn 1 to 0 and 0 to 1, which we can do by flipping the last bit, for example, there's some other ways we could do it too, then we'll get that result. So our overall solution looks like this. Questions on how I got that? Okay. So our last step is how do we get rid of that constraint that X is 0 or 1? And the easiest thing to do is to take this solution and first do something where we take X and we transform it to 0 or 1 from like 0 or any big number. And a cheap way of doing that in C, but not a way which really makes sense in hardware, is using the logical negation operator. Because if I take exclamation point X, that's going to be 1 or 0. And then if I take exclamation point X again, that's going to be 0 or 1 if it was 1 or 0. So if we like start with 2, exclamation point 2 is 0, exclamation point 2 is 1, because exclamation point 0 is always 1. Because remember, like x equals 2 in C returns 0 or 1. The same thing applies to the exclamation point operator. So this is a kind of cheap way of doing it, but maybe it doesn't seem to fit the spirit of actually using simple operations, and I would agree. But it certainly follows the letter, and in the blob, you'll see another way of avoiding this exclamation point operator that maybe perhaps makes sense. So questions about this? Okay, so I think, well, I'll just finish up by mentioning, so you might think that using these bitwise operators is faster. They're simpler, but the hardware, well, they care about add as much as them. So add is about as fast as bitwise AND. Just to let you know so you don't think it's faster, we're doing these puzzles again to help you understand hardware and sort of how do the bitwise operators work, not because you should be doing this in all your code. And next time, I'll talk a bit more about other bit puzzle strategies.